It's the Burt Cohen Show. And is it a dream for everybody or a dream just for a few at the top? What the heck is going on with our economy? There's all this talk about raising the debt ceiling and what happens if we don't do that, and on and on. And the two parties are posturing, oh, just a little bit, as we know. But maybe there's a lot more to it than we're seeing. You know, it's being presented to us, but I'm sure there's more underneath it. There's a lot more to the story than we are hearing about. And part of this recession is that the middle class has been devastated, and there's a growing split between rich and poor and economic equality. And our guest today hopes to speak about that in the first half hour. Robert Creamer, thanks for being with us, Bob. Are you there? Oh, my goodness. I need to push this button. Bob, are you there?
I'm here, Bert. Oh, be with you.
Oh, good, good, good. Good to have you back. It's been a little while. And we're talking about the economy and the fact that the middle class has been really hurt, and that there's a few very wealthy people and a lot of people who used to be in the middle class. And I guess some of the question is this a result or perhaps a cause of the economic stagnation in which the nation now finds itself?
Yeah, I feel very strongly that the fundamental underlying problem in the American economy is the suppression of income in the middle class. I mean, somebody once said to me the other day, the problem in the economy today is not confidence, it's customers. I mean, you know, the business community is sitting on $2 trillion with a T of cash. It's not that they're not investing that because they're bad people. They're not investing it because they don't think they have customers out there. And you know, this is about demand. Job creators are people who are customers, demanders of products and services. And, you know, you could go along for some time with a low rate of or no rate of growth among middle-class incomes that we've had for all these years by expanding the credit, you know, that people had. But that's a house of cards that ultimately came tumbling down, and that's why we're having such a hard time rebuilding this economy. It's we need to get people out there who have money in their pockets to buy stuff, and that really requires we got to put money directly into jobs, in my view.
Well, it does seem that you may be at odds with some of the Republican leadership in the House and Senate, oddly enough. I know, what a surprise.
Oddly enough.
That the term job creators has replaced wealthy and powerful people. When I hear Mitch McConnell and others, they talk about, well, we have to help the job creators. And that's an interesting way of translating it, as you know, people say, and I've heard Republican friends of mine say that, well, poor people don't create jobs; it's the wealthy people who create jobs. And it's fascinating how they just change the terminology, and language, as you know, Bob, is so important that you know, it's about the job creators, not the plutocrats.
I mean, you know, the people who are job creators are the people who demand products. I mean, that's and you know, the strength of the private sector portion of our economy, and we have a very mixed economy, but the strength of the private sector part is that it's so responsive to any kind of demand. You know, I mean, entrepreneurs and small businesses and so on, the moment there seems a glimmer of possibility, somebody may demand a product or service, there's somebody around to try and provide it. That's wonderful. The downside, the weak side of this private sector is that without that, nothing's cooking. They're just not going to do it. You got to have the public sector intervene to not only provide stimulus for the private sector, but also to assure that the public services that are just as much jobs as public private sector jobs, that's one of their other things, right, that the public sector work jobs are not real jobs.
Right.
Ask that next time you call a fireman or a cop or, or an air traffic. Get on an airplane, and how likely are you to get on an airplane without an air traffic controller, you know, to keep people from, you know, falling from the sky?
And we need these infrastructure, the solidity of the infrastructure, people doing the fire, the police, the air traffic controllers, as you say. We all depend on that. You can't have businesses without highways, for example. You can't have businesses without an electric grid. But the right is saying that, you know, that's the government getting involved, spending our tax dollars. That's not the right way to go. They say that untethering the free market, you know, this kind of a worship of something they describe as the free market, freeing them from burdensome government relations, government regulations. The economy will right itself. Just let the free market go. That if they're taxed less, they, the job creators, will have more money to invest in making more stuff consumers want. People seem to be buying that. Why?
Well, you know what? I don't think people do buy it. I mean, they like to pretend. They like to try and convince people that other people that the public buys that. That's really just not true. I mean, you look at the polling. 70% of people don't want to cut Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid.
Right.
80% think the best way to deal with the budget deficit is to tax millionaires, billionaires, oil companies, and CEOs right around in flat private jets. I mean, that the public's with us on these things. I got to say, you know, we just had an experiment of 10 years of cutting taxes for the rich. At the end of the decade that experiment took place, was the only decade in modern American history that there was not one net private sector job created. I mean, it was a total failure. And to have these guys talk about this as if it just ignores history is shocking. And, you know, one of the things that just always shocks me is the degree of amnesia people, a lot of these folks have. Remember, we had a budget surplus as far as the eye could see at the end of the Clinton administration. And the only reason we don't today is not because of some structural problem in the budget situation. It's because we cut taxes for the wealthy, conducted two wars without paying for them, and set up a whole new program under Medicare for drugs that was not paid for in any way. And then you're surprised that there's a budget deficit? I mean, these guys are like, they pretend to be like your conservative, responsible, rich uncle. And in fact, they're like the reckless teenager that got the keys too early. I mean, these guys spent like crazy people, teenagers, and left us this horrible economic disaster.
We are talking with Robert Creamer, longtime political organizer and strategist, author of the book Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. And he's a partner in the firm Democracy Partners. And we, in the heated discussion, you know, a couple of egos posturing, just here and there, about cutting the federal deficit, which hadn't really been that much of an effort in people's minds before now, the right is digging in its heels against any increase in taxes, because it's so easy to say, well, I'm against increasing taxes. The Democrats, tax and spend. We've heard this broken record for decades now. But wouldn't lowering taxes put more money in the pockets of the middle class as well as the business class?
Well, to be honest with you, in the very near term, I'm personally of the school that it's not a bad thing to continue the payroll tax holiday for individuals, not for businesses, because that will do nothing, to put more money in the hands of middle class people who are potentially consumers.
Right.
But lowering taxes on the rich does nothing. They don't need more cash. I mean, they got a lot of the business has a huge amount of cash sitting around. The problem is not cash in the hands of rich people. The problem is cash in the hands of everybody else.
Yeah.
And I would argue that the fundamental underlying problem to the economic stagnation we have today is the decline of money in the hands of average people to buy products. The concentration of the fact every dime of economic growth has gone to the top 2% of the population in the last almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that is an unsustainable situation because, if productivity has gone up, continues to go up, but if the amount of money going to the potential purchasers of product doesn't go off proportionally with productivity, then people, by definition, will not have enough money in their pockets to buy the new products and services that productivity will produce, and you have economic stagnation. That's just kind of obvious. Let me just add, by the way, I think this current crisis that is the debt ceiling crisis. We've managed, I think, to make it very clear that the Republicans are willing to risk the economy, to risk default, to risk potentially another financial meltdown, in order to protect the
wealthiest.
The wealthiest people, millionaires, billionaires, oil companies, CEOs who fly around in corporate jets from any kind of tax increase. That's shocking to most Americans, and I think that that's exactly where we're going to be. And my guess is, at the end of the day, they're going to back away from that at the behest of frankly, big business, which is eager to have all those tax breaks, but not eager to have a collapse in the economy. and I'm guessing that we've got a situation here where the business guys have allowed the Tea Party types to run around and growl and bark and howl for a while, and now there's going to be a little obedience training that they're not, they're going to tighten up on the leash here.
Well, that is interesting language, and language is so important, as we say. And the power behind the Tea Party, has been the exceptionally wealthy and powerful, the Koch brothers, obviously, the Americans for Prosperity. I wonder how they're going to do it. Well, maybe this lifting the debt ceiling discussion may be the tool for, as you say, putting the leash on these guys that are running around barking, making so much noise. And I wonder about what is the Obama administration? Robert, you argue very clearly that this is what the people want, to tax the wealthiest people, the top 2 or even 1%, a little bit more, do away with the very bad idea of the Bush tax cuts, which didn't help the economy one bit. The people are for that. Okay, where is Obama? Where are the Democrats in Congress? Are they so enamored of and in the pockets of Wall Street, the very wealthy people? Are they in the pockets of the same wealthy people that the Republican Party is now in? What's going on there? Why aren't they listening to the people? Or are
First off, Bert, I think the Democrats in the House have just been absolutely ironclad. They are not about to vote for anything that includes cutting Medicare, Social Security benefits.
Right, that's good.
Or frankly, shifting the burden on Medicaid in a way that would cut benefits for Medicaid. I think the Democrats in the House have been really clear about that. The president has basically put the Republicans in a corner by saying, look, let's do a big deal here. I think he probably, in my personal judgment, he could have done that without address. I think he probably should have said he's not going to put benefits of Medicare or Social Security on the table. But in the end, he certainly got the political high ground with these guys. I do not believe that we will see a deal that will cut Medicare or Social Security benefits an iota. And that in the end of the day, I mean, I think yesterday we saw McConnell blink. I think we saw with his proposal to allow the president to raise the debt ceiling without any of these cuts. I think in the end, the Republicans have run into a box canyon here. And they've been saying, oh, no, we're not going to do anything. It doesn't have big cuts and no taxes. And the president has been very clear, if we're going to have some kind of a serious bargain, we're going to have tax revenue increases from the rich. and they are not, so they're now in a situation where they either have to agree to raise taxes on wealthy people, kind of the holy grail for them, or let the country go into default and be held responsible for an economic collapse, which, as McConnell pointed out, would be a disaster for them, or sue for peace without any of those things, and basically try and sign up terms of surrender. And I'm guessing that last thing will ultimately happen. And I feel very confident, by the way, that the president will be very clear. He ain't signing nothing that is at least serious in terms of cuts in anything without increases in revenue. I don't believe. We'll see.
And, well, that, as you say, the Republicans have absolutely boxed themselves into a corner, and there's just incredible posturing going on now. And how can, in terms of posture and in terms of how they appear to the nation, you know, everybody, all these guys have to appear really strong and like they're not the ones to blink. They made the other guys blink. We've seen wars start over such things. If they're in this box and saying no new taxes, no tax, you know, no repealing of the Bush tax cut, no increasing taxes on the wealthiest people, how can they possibly blink? How don't they need some safe way, some escape hatch that they can have? And, you know, they're boxed into such a corner there. How can they still look good and look strong and look powerful if they're the ones that blink? Can they dare do that?
Well, I think that's why. I mean, the problem is the real base of the Republican Party is Wall Street and the CEO class.
Yes.
I mean, all the Tea Party gang, you know, they've kind of been fodder for them for years. But now you got a bunch of these people who boxed them into these commitments and are Tea Party, you know, true believers, and you've got the potential of a civil war in the caucus between Cantor, the majority leader, and
Boehner.
And Boehner, whose leash is a little tighter with Wall Street, I think. And all of that causes big problems, both for a resolution and for in the Republican Party. I think the end result will probably be that there is going to be a McConnell-like solution to the immediate crisis. That is to say, McConnell says, let's let the president raise this. He has to send it to Congress, and we'll say no, but then he can veto that. You know, I mean, this is all just smoke and mirrors to cover his retreat. So I think they're going to collapse is what I think in the end.
Well, that's what they need to cover their retreat, because they don't want to be seen as retreating. They want the other guys to win out. We're talking about the causes of this current massive discussion and heated argument about keeping us, pulling America, our economy, back from the edge of the abyss that we're seeing in Greece and in Italy and in Ireland even now, which has been reduced to junk bonds. That would be, everybody recognizes that would be just a total disaster for this country.
I would say this, though, Bert. You know, I mean, the notion that, and the right says this, we don't want to be like Greece or whatever. You know, Greece has 142% of its GDP in debt. It's a small economy that is subject, that has a currency that it has to pay its bills in that it doesn't control. The United States is currently paying virtually nothing in interest rates on government bonds. It is viewed today as the safest investment in the world. Now, if we intentionally default, it will raise our interest rates and cost the government lots of money and potentially spook the financial markets worldwide and cause a potential economic disaster in all sorts of ways. But if we don't default intentionally, there is no reason to believe that our interest rates are, the interest rates we're paying on bonds are going to go up substantially in the near term. I mean, this notion that we're going to be like Greece is just crazy. We control our currency. The Federal Reserve sets interest rates in the United States. I mean, there's no indication that worldwide financial markets are going to somehow say, oh, not invest in the United States anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of AAA bonds is the level of security of the Treasury bill of the United States of America. So, you know, I think that's a right-wing myth we've got to be careful to avoid kind of buying into. That's what spooks everybody about how we've got to deal with this deficit. The deficit issue is certainly an important issue. It's not nearly as important an issue as creating jobs in our economy now.
Yeah.
And my view is that the next, what we've got to do, what the president's got to do, Democrats in Congress have got to do, is offer, and they've got two sets of problems. One is to do the best they can to stimulate the economy, given the Republican control of the House, on their own. But we need also to come with a proposal, whether it can pass or not, that says, you know, we're going to not just incent businesses and stuff to create jobs, we're going to create a bunch of jobs. And we're going to create a job, a teacher corps. We're going to do all the things that really have to be done and pay for them directly. We know how to create jobs.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, we created huge numbers of jobs for the WPA and CCC.
Absolutely.
There's lots of ways to do this. And we just laid off 500,000 people at the state level because of lack of funding at states. You know, we could basically create a teacher corps or a repair the schools corps, where we pay people directly, pay the states to hire people directly to do jobs that desperately need to be done, and put people to work to spend money in the economy and really start the economy moving again.
Now, Robert Creamer, you and I, we talk about that. A few people talk about that, how, you know, what FDR did, frankly, worked. And World War II, everybody says, well, it wasn't the FDR, the New Deal that ended, it was World War II. Well, because it created a lot of jobs. It was a huge spending and a lot of jobs. That's what ended the war. There's Obama had this tremendous mandate, the hope, the change, and, you know, the elections of 2012 are here now, basically. This is, I think, what most people want. Do you see any evidence that they're getting it? And if they don't get it, what are they just buying into the Republican language? Why is there such fear of talking about an actual stimulation? You know, people say, well, the stimulus failed because it was too small. It was just minuscule.
Small.
Yeah, but do you see any backbone coming up in supporting this on the Hill in Washington?
Well, you know, in fairness to the administration, I think at the beginning of his term, and that was the time when there was a mandate that he probably could have done a lot more in.
Absolutely.
I think there was an underestimate of the degree of damage that the economy had suffered and what would be required. And in retrospect, I think a lot of people there would agree that they should have pushed much harder for using every weapon they could to jumpstart the economy and to get a demand going again and to... But I got to tell you, I was involved in this. It was hard to pass the stimulus bill that was passed, and so would they have been successful? They would certainly have set themselves up for a better situation than they have now by at least being clear what the problem was at the beginning and its magnitude, because that tended to undermine their credibility at this stage. There are
so
a bunch of things they can do of their own accord that I think they're going to work hard to do to stimulate the economy without having to have the Republicans in Congress pass it in the House. I mean, their problem is we've got all these Republicans in the House that don't believe that stimulating the economy is a thing to do, which is just crazy. But as I say, I think there will be, and I think they will consider seriously coming with a proposal of their own. I think Democrats in the House and Senate have to come with proposals that are very clear about what needs to be done to create jobs themselves, and I think there's serious consideration being given to doing that right away. I know my wife is in Congress, is seriously considering a bill right now to promote that. I think the month of August there's going to be a lot of action around the country around these kind of proposals. We've got to really push hard on this, I think.
So once the debt ceiling debate is over, then perhaps Congress can get around to doing the real work of actual job creation. There seems to be such fear of doing that. I really don't know why, but there seems to be a fear of doing that. And it seems like the language has kind of been owned really since the Reagan times, which, going back to our original focus here, is, you know, it's destroyed the middle class. And it seems like it's almost been intentional to do that. And now we got to, I hope the Democrats can start doing stuff to really build up the middle class. And it sounds like, Robert, you're always the optimist. I always appreciate that about you. And you're working directly in there in Congress and with the White House to make this stuff happen. I thank you for coming on the show again, and for I hope that it'll actually happen. You think it will?
Well, I think what's important is that people all over America demand it, that they understand there is a big difference between Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you know, and that they hold accountable these Republicans. I mean, we're in your neck of the woods, there's a bunch of Republicans who need to be held very heavily accountable.
Yes.
For their horrific policies. And, I mean, it's absolutely critical for the future that we retake control of Congress, keep control of the Senate, and have the re-election of the president. Otherwise, we're headed for another dark age economically, I mean, and politically. But to do that, I do believe we've also got to demand of all of our leaders that we get bold and tough on this question of job creation. And it's, you know, one of the big problems of the last couple months has been that the right, by this enormous domination of the dialogue about the deficit, has distracted political attention and capital from the real dominant concern of the American people, and that is creating more jobs. And that's where we got to be now.
Let's see if we can do that. And you know, there's this group I'm sure you know of called No Labels, which is, to me, doing exactly the wrong thing of, you know, getting away from a Democratic identity and away from any kind of backbone for the Democratic Party. And that's exactly, in my opinion, what we don't need. I do you see much strength for them in Washington? I hope not.
No.
Good.
No, I don't think so at all. You know, don't you think, Bert, I mean, there's been a, I mean, I know that there's we have to make it very clear there are two different sets of values and visions here. And
yes,
while progressives may not think that all Democrats or the administration always goes as far as we need, let's be clear. There's a big difference between the Republican view of the world and the Democratic view of the world, the progressive view and the conservative view. We want to push it to make it further, but we got to unite the country. We got to unite a majority around our point of view and win. This is about winning, not complaining. And that's what we've got to go out and do and organize as best we can between now and 2013. And yeah, just one other kind of way to think about this.
Well,
in the first two years of the administration, we really took a lot of ground for progressives, I think, with the health care bill and the Wall Street reform and all that kind of stuff. Then the empire struck back. And now we've got to hold our ground and prepare a counteroffensive to start making progress once again.
Wow, sounds good. I was reminded of so much history, and the fact that FDR is famous for saying to A. Philip Randolph, "I'm with you. This is on race relations and civil rights. I'm with you. I want to help you. Now make me do it." And that's what the people have to do, is stand up, make some noise, and as you say in your book, stand up straight, how progressives can win. Thank you, Robert Kramer, for being with us again on the Bert Cohen
Show. Talk to you, Bert.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. And we will be back talking about drones, the drone wars, after we take this little break, talking about money. Hope we can get some money back into the hands of the middle class. Remember, there used to be a middle class in the United States, and a lot of the money that we pay in taxes, of course, is going to the area known euphemistically as defense, making war, propping up military contractors. We have this huge, huge military welfare system, which the weapons contractors, used to be known as the war profiteers, are doing pretty darn well on. And it never seems to be cut. And one area of the military contractors, of course, is the lovely new toys, weapon systems, always looking for bigger and better weapon systems that somehow are supposed to help America. Well, there's something now called drones. You hear about them more and more every day. And I'm very pleased to have with us investigative journalist with Global Research, Rick Rosoff. You've written about drones and what they are and what's going on with them. What exactly is a drone and what is their mission? And how long have they even been in existence? We've only started hearing about them just recently, it seems.
No, you're correct. I think far too little attention has been brought to what has aptly been called, and I've even used the title in an article of my own, The Decade of the Drone, to define the past 10 years preceding this. It's an unmanned aerial vehicle is the official, UAV is the official designation for the drones. And what they are is remote piloted, initially surveillance aircraft. There are various types. They've become more sophisticated. They've also been armed recently and have become increasingly more lethal. But they originally were used in the Balkans in the 1990s, over the Bosnian Serb Republic in 1994 and 1995, and then with the 78-day NATO bombing campaign against Yugoslavia in 1999. But in the new millennium, in the new century, they've been used as for killing people and killing a good deal of them, a good number of them. And the most frequently used one, the names speak volumes. I mean, there's no attempt by the Pentagon to disguise their intent. The most commonly used drone is the Predator. But it's been superseded by one called the Reaper, as in Grim Reaper, one of them. And both are equipped with Hellfire missiles, air-to-surface missiles, which have wreaked pretty deadly toll in nations like Pakistan and Yemen, and most recently Libya, and also, as of late, Somalia. It's been calculated the U.S. has now used the Predator and Reaper drones for military purposes, for firing missiles in six countries. They were initially used in Iraq after the invasion of 2003 and in Afghanistan itself in recent years. So you now have drone warfare occurring in six different countries, ranging from North Africa to the Chinese border in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah. And so the first time, Rick, that these were used was in Iraq after the American invasion 2003, so they were nice new toys back then?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we have to look at the battle zones of the last 12 years in particular, as being, amongst other things, public hardware displays for U.S. weaponry, which then has a dual purpose, one to convince other nations allied with the United States or that could be recruited into such an alliance that they had better come on board and buy some of their own, or this is what will happen to you. I mean, I fear is, one of the intentions, as cynical as that is. So that initially Predator drones were used in Iraq, Reaper drones have also been used. The United States has also deployed Reaper unmanned aerial vehicles to the East African island nation of Seychelles at the end of 2009, supposedly strictly for surveillance purposes, but one wonders if they're not going to be used a little further north in both Somalia and Yemen.
So these drones, I have, of course, no idea how much they cost and, what their payload is. I guess they call it a payload for the various different missiles that are on there.
Yeah.
What is their scope in terms of size, weapons, money?
I really don't have the figures on, what a Predator or a Reaper cost or how much each Hellfire missile they fire cost. I do know this, that last year a Marine general was speaking at a conference in the United States and said that in the first year of this century, 2001, the United States had, or the Pentagon, had 200 unmanned aerial vehicles in its arsenal, 200. But that by last year, 2010, they had 6,000 and anticipated having 8,000 by next year. That's a 40-fold increase.
Oh, my.
And again, they're progressing from, the Predator to the Reaper, which has an estimated capacity to carry 15 times as much military ordnance, travels at three times speed, and so forth. And there are yet more sophisticated versions coming behind that. So what we're looking at, several journalists have written on the subject of drones and drone warfare. I don't know that anyone has really identified, what a defining phenomenon or development this has become. That, in fact, drone warfare combined with cruise missile warfare has become modern 21st century warfare. When after 60 days of military actions against Libya on May the 20th, the bombing began on March 19th, the U.S. Congress put some pressure on the White House to abide by the War Powers Resolution of 1973. The statement from the White House stated in so many words that what the U.S. was engaging, and keep in mind that towards the end of that 60-day period, the United States had deployed Predator drones with Hellfire missiles to the Libyan war theater, that these actions didn't constitute hostilities as defined in the War Powers Resolution because American troops were not in harm's way in so many words. In other words, by using robotic weapons like drones or cruise missiles. Incidentally, at the end of May, the deputy commander of the Russian general staff of the armed forces estimated that at the end of this decade, the United States and its Western allies, which say its allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, will have 80,000 cruise missiles, 2,000 of which can be equipped for nuclear warheads. So I think combining this, this vast, unprecedented arsenal of cruise missiles with, an estimated 12,000 minimum, I'm sorry, 8,000 minimum drones. By the way, I saw an article the other day that says the United States has 7,000 Reaper drones alone. You know, if that's true, then the figure of 8,000 has been exceeded pretty substantially. And what we're looking at, and we also now have hypersonic, prompt global strike unmanned aircraft in the works. There have been two tests for the latest version of that. So I think what you're looking at is, robotic, remote, activated and controlled warfare going on worldwide, where troops are not going to be placed on the ground or in threat or in any way threatening their own the ultimate force protection, if you will.
So is the point of the drone system protecting American personnel, military personnel, keeping them out of harm's way? That sounds like, in a way, the ideal weapon system. So it doesn't, nobody has to be on it. It can all be run remotely. But what does it mean to the people on the ground? Is it not true that one of the advantages to drones is that they can be more surgically targeted than other weapons, avoiding civilian casualties?
I mean, that is the claim. But I think the facts speak otherwise. For example, in January of last year, one of the more prestigious newspapers in Pakistan, and arguably the widest circulation English-language newspaper, Dawn News, reported citing defense officials with the Defense Ministry of Pakistan, that of the 714 people killed in what's called the federally administered tribal areas, Fatah, in northwest Pakistan in the year 2009, that only five of those were either al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters. If that's true, that's more than 140-to-1 ratio of other people, presumably unarmed civilians, or if armed, local people carry arms as a matter of course in that part of the country. We also know in a report from the Persian Gulf, United Arab Emirates, in a newspaper called The National, not too long ago, that in this case, citing a defense official with the government of Yemen, that in the first few days, less than 2 weeks of last month, June, that U.S. drone strikes killed an estimated 130 people in Yemen. The estimates there, again, are, they're not necessarily al-Shabaab, they're not necessarily al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula fighters, but, in many instances, civilians are simply... So if these are smart weapons that supposedly, micromanage the killing, targeted killing, as the State Department refers to it, of, terrorists, however they're defined, then I think the facts speak to a quite different situation, that in fact there's a widespread killing of civilians. For example, estimates vary and they're hard to get accurate figures on, but since the drone attacks inside the tribal belt in Pakistan began 7 years ago in 2004, estimates are, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500 people have been killed, but 2,100 roughly of those, 7/8, have been killed since the beginning of 2009, that is, since the change in presidential administrations in the United States, and that just since the beginning of last month, June, there are an estimated 135 to 140 people killed in drone strikes in Pakistan, which is about twice the total amount killed in the entire year of 2007. So we're seeing an intensification of these attacks. They are not as smart or select or accurate as they're touted as being. And what we're seeing is deaths now in the thousands from global drone warfare.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Rick Rosoff, investigative journalist with Global Research, about drones. And so one of the purposes is to keep American military personnel out of harm's way.
It's risk-free warfare. Only the other side suffers in blood and people being maimed and killed.
Well, so how the other side, okay, it's being effective at that, protecting American troops. That's pretty swell in terms of military policy, I'm sure. But the other goal is, all right, there's got to be some goal of the war, and that's fighting Al-Qaeda, I believe. So we're using drones in many different countries. I believe you say like six different countries. And on the ground in Pakistan, which is a very, very important area, and it seems to be teetering right now. We need, as we learned, well, hopefully learned in Vietnam, that if you don't have the hearts and minds of the people, you can't win a war. And so what is the effect of drones on the goals of Obama's war against Al-Qaeda?
That's a very good question, and it's hard to answer because everything seems counterintuitive. You know, for example, a recent Pew Research Center poll inside Pakistan, found that only 3% of Pakistanis surveyed support the drone strikes. I don't know how many, have some neutral position, but I would guess that means something in the 90 percentile range oppose such strikes. So in terms of the hearts and minds of the Pakistani people, I think we've lost them. And even to the extent that it's putting in mounting pressure on the government to back up its covert support of U.S. Drone strikes. Just recently, the Pakistani government essentially evicted the Pentagon from an air base in its province of Balochistan from where drone strikes had been launched, necessitating the U.S. to shift them to refurbished or upgraded air bases in Afghanistan near the Pakistani border. So I can't imagine in any scenario in which, and by the way, I'm glad you raised the Indo-Chinese parallel. The drone attacks inside Pakistan and the intensification also of not only U.S. but NATO helicopter gunship attacks, mortar and other shelling inside Pakistan, which have resulted in the deaths of Pakistani servicemen, in many ways parallels the expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia in 1970 by President Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And we know with what results, inside Cambodia itself, and for how long, the Cambodian people suffered the consequences of, that action. Listeners in the United States will recall that, during the 2008 presidential campaign, that then-Senator Barack Obama mentioned on several occasions, and I'm paraphrasing him almost exactly, that if the United States has information or evidence that there are terrorists operating within Pakistan and the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to take action, then we will do so. Well, that's certainly one campaign promise he delivered on, to the tune of, perhaps 2,100 people killed in the interim.
So, yeah, and I'm also reminded about Vietnam that a lot of the political pressure on Richard Nixon was that Americans are being killed and maimed in Vietnam. So they had this program of Vietnamization. They pulled the combat troops out and increased the bombing, which, was very intensive. And as you mentioned, in Cambodia, there was this unbelievable carpet bombing, this absolute terror bombing in Cambodia, which did not work real well. It just made people angrier. I can't help that believe. And I keep hearing, if one is paying attention at all to the news and focusing on Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan and Afghanistan, places like that, there keep being these little oops moments where the U.S. military has to apologize because of drone attacks that kill a lot of civilians. So I wonder, what is going on? And we saw what happened in Vietnam. It only stiffened their resolve to fight for their own self-government. On the civilian population and then political stability and the relations in the U.S. in these various areas. So the countries that the areas that we're talking about, Richard, that my sense is, what is it, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. What else am I missing here? And how's it working?
Libya.
Oh, Libya, of course, Libya. And how it's because there's no military troops involved, therefore it's not a war situation. This is pretty slippery stuff here. But how is it working with the political stability of those regions and, again, coming back to the fight against al-Qaeda?
No, you're correct about the slippery slope argument. It's, in a way, a de facto tearing to shreds of the the war powers the war powers resolution 1973, mm-hmm. Which was forced, if you will, on the Nixon administration at that time, and may have been the one good thing that came out of the Vietnam War. If that is now essentially negated, and there have been comments by former U.S. government officials saying exactly that. If you're using high-tech weaponry, then you can, as the White House has recently done, you can claim this isn't war at all because, U.S. troops are not, in actual combat situations, and somebody sitting at a base in Nevada is calling in a drone strike in Pakistan or Libya, that this is a clean, risk-free sort of war. It's a dangerous threshold that's been crossed, and it's a dangerous precedent that's been created. We also have to look at other facts. A report from the United Nations that surfaced in the last day or so indicate that over 1,400 Afghan civilians have been killed to date this year, and that's at a higher rate than last year, which was the deadliest in the history of what will soon be a 10-year war. So, if we extrapolate from the figures to date, then what we're looking at is for Afghan civilians, as well as government troops, NATO troops, and insurgents, it'll be the deadliest of the 10 years of the war, which, by the way, is the longest continuous combat operations, the longest war in America's history. It's by far the largest war in Afghanistan's history. By probably a year and a half now, exceeding the period of Soviet intervention, and so we're seeing a massive dislocation. According to Refugees International, an NGO based in the United States, that in the last 2 years, 250,000, quarter of a million Afghans have been forced to flee their villages and towns, in large part, according to Refugees International, because of NATO bombing and NATO so-called night raids, that is special forces operations. So you're talking about a dislocation, this 10 years into the war, a dislocation of a quarter of a million Afghan people in the last 2 years. When they issued their report, Refugees International, a couple of weeks ago, the total this year to date was 91,000, which was a 50% increase over the same period the preceding year, last year. So you're talking about massive dislocation of civilians, destabilization, unprecedented or mounting, deaths and so forth. So, if the intent is to in any way, stabilize situations, even from a narrow point of view of U.S. geopolitical interests, it's been a signal failure. It's produced the opposite.
I couldn't imagine how it wouldn't be. So if it's not really working, not helping American interest to win the hearts and minds of the people in these countries, and in fact is clearly doing the opposite, I'm curious, by what legal authority is the U.S. using the drones in these countries? Do they have to get approval from somebody in those countries? What is their approval for it? Well, obviously, Congress hasn't been involved with it. The Constitution seems to have gone by the wayside here. But how do they get away with it? What's their legal authority, the U.S. military using the drones?
Well, the chief legal advisor to the State Department, to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is a fellow named Harold Koh, K-O-H. And his argument has been that the U.S. has a right to bomb villages in North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and South Asia in the name of U.S. self-defense, which is mind-boggling. It's worse than that. It's morally repulsive. and that he refers to those killings as targeted killings as opposed to targeted assassination.
Hmm.
And targeted assassination, of course, is in flagrant violation of international law, also of U.S. law, you know,
yes.
since the 1970s, and the Senate and House investigations of the Central Intelligence Agency and so forth. So, you know, they simply change the name. You know, the reason they can get away with it, in addition to, you know, very compliant client regimes in countries like Pakistan and Yemen, and the so-called transitional federal government, such as it is in the Somali capital of Mogadishu, which will permit the U.S. anything. The reason they get away with it is there's not international state governmental opposition. There's no opposition in the United Nations, and I'm afraid, you know, there's no mass anti-war sentiment or even substantial anti-war sentiment that can be marshaled in the United States and in other nations to decry this carnage, because it really is. When you start talking about people being killed in the thousands. You know, very questionable targeting strategy and so forth. And you're talking about something that I don't think would have been tolerated or ignored to the degree it is, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. There's been desensitization, you know, of the mass political thinking, I think, in the United States and globally.
Hmm.
And it's time to really, you know, address people's, you know, moral indignation as well as political opposition to these killings.
You're right. It doesn't seem to be happening right now. But it took a long time for the American population to rise up about our war in Vietnam. It did take a really long time after the war was going. And we're just hearing more and more and more about the use of drones and the absolute terror that it's creating amongst huge populations. And clearly, I just can't imagine how it can be achieving any goals in the interest of the United States. And, you know, aside from questions of morality strategically, it ain't working. What about Congress? Has there been any voice in Congress at all questioning this? My guess is, well, maybe...
two people, and you know who they are. They're Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. And, you know, maybe an occasional colleague joining them. But, you know, for the most part, those are the two voices of, you know, consistent anti-intervention. And from, if you will, opposite ends of the political spectrum, but unified
sure.
on, you know, on that point, you know, to both their credits, to the credit of both, rather. And, you know, the other thing, too, is we talk about, you know, needing time to, you know, develop opposition to the war as in Vietnam. You know, with Vietnam, after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution mm-hmm. and the commencement of direct U.S. and independent U.S. military operations, including bombing of the north of the country. It only took a couple of years for mass demonstrations to occur. This is, again, as of October 7th of this year, will be 10 years of U.S. waging war in Afghanistan. And I'm afraid it goes back to, and let me share, share a brief anecdote. 1999, I was at work at lunch with colleagues at work, and I informed them I was going to the anti-war demonstration in Washington at that time because of the bombing of Yugoslavia. And one of my co-workers mentioned to me, what do you have any problem with that for? No Americans have been killed. And, you know, I fear that, you know, if the U.S. death toll in Afghanistan was several times what it was, you would have more opposition. But, you know, that's the only criterion for determining. Whether we accept these kinds of actions, which is to say, you know, how many Americans have been killed, and that a quarter of a million Afghans being displaced or 2,500 people in northwest Pakistan being killed is a matter of, you know, seeming indifference, you know, to the body politic and the populace in the United States is really an indictment.
Hmm.
You know, about how things have proceeded politically in the neoliberal age and in the, you know, the 20 years of the post-Cold War period.
Well, we have been talking about drones and drone warfare. Are there any, I mean, there's a lot of organizations out there, certainly on the left. Are there any, Rick, that you can cite that maybe raising this issue, that people, if they're interested in, you know, raising the issue of this, you know, antiseptic way of fighting war, of killing a lot of other people and not putting any of our guys at risk, what can people do?
You know, there, if you could do a web search, I just did one myself as we're talking, and there's a website called nodrones.com, which they made it easy on us.
Yeah.
And,
we need it that way.
Yeah, I mean, they should all be like that. And, you know, thanks for piquing my curiosity. I wouldn't have looked at that. It's for, with Code Pink. with Media Benjamin and Company.
Excellent.
And I see that on their website they're talking about actions against the drones at the Creech Air Force Base in the U.S. with Cindy Sheehan. Yeah. So, definitely, it's Code Pink. The website is called NoDrones.com. I've got to get in there and contact them. And I'm sure there are other initiatives of that sort, but that's the most direct.
All right. Well, Rick Rosa, very, very informative. I'd like to be in touch with you in the future because I have a feeling there'd be other issues coming up as this war on Al-Qaeda or whatever it is that Obama is doing keeps on doing whatever the heck it's doing. Rick Rosoff of Global Research, thanks very much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
I really appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you, Bert. Thanks.
All right, thank you. And do email me, bert@bertcohen.com. Thanks very much for listening.
Flying in the wind, down through the planets on the road.